This is tape 9, side 17, and it's still 16th of January, 1997, and we're continuing with Rabbi Walter Jacob, and you're going to mention that there are 600 members, and 300 are rabbis, and 300 are lay.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay.
By now we also have, or are beginning to get, a significant number of conservative rabbis, too. It's not limited entirely to Reform rabbis, by any means. And we've had conservative rabbis on our academic board for some time. What the effort of this is to increase an interest in halakha, and I ought to indicate that halakha is Jewish law in general, which is includes codes and responsa, Talmud, and all of that, while responsa is just a segment of this. The interest in Jewish law has risen, and in order to keep our members informed, I began 4 years ago, or 5 years ago, I suppose, to publish a newsletter called Halakha, but it's more than a newsletter, it's almost a little journal, because it has no news of the organization, no lists of donors or anything like that, but instead some substantive articles and a responsum or two, as well as book reviews and that sort of thing. And as we are now beginning to be more international with the next issue, well, not the next issue, that's about to come out, but the issue after that, we're going to have synopses in German and in French, and so that will become a little broader, something that a lot of Jewish magazines really ought to do, but don't.
Now, where is this published?
It's published right here in Pittsburgh, and the work is done in Pittsburgh and in Tel Aviv. Moshe Zemer takes care of Israel and does quite a bit of representing us there with various halachic bodies, struggles with the Orthodox, writes for Haaretz quite frequently, has written a very nice book called The Sane Halacha, thus far only available in Hebrew, but it'll be translated into English. And he also works in Eastern Europe. And I take care of North America and Western Europe. And we also have people elsewhere. I met with some individuals in Australia when I was there.
And how are these distributed?
By mail. And we're also in touch with a lot of people by email, of course, these days.
So that is... Does that, but you say that hasn't made it easier because you still write? And
well, you have to write, but email, for example, when we edit books, Moshe Zemer and I try to edit books together, most of it ends up being done here because it still is difficult to edit by email. The amount of stuff you have to transfer is so large.
And you use fax as well?
Use fax, yeah. Too, but if you're talking about a couple of hundred pages, you really don't want to fax somebody a couple of hundred pages.
Is there anything else that you want to tell us about the response?
It's moving along very nicely, and I think now that I'm retired, I will have more time to, first of all, see to it that we membership increases, that the books sell more broadly, though it's surprising how well they sell. Some of the books have been selected as textbooks and college courses. But it takes time. You know, I've not spent any time on what you would call public relations or marketing. But with a little effort, I'm sure that'll work out well. And the support, interestingly enough, the financial support has been very good.
And where does it come from?
From the members. And
is there a membership fee?
There's a membership fee. It starts at $25. And for that you get a book and three or four issues of this a journal every year. But there are quite a number of sizable gifts. Got a gift last year of over $5,000, and another gift for a translation project of $10,000. So people are...
Find out where that... Would you be interested in telling us where the money came from?
No, just from interested people.
Now, you said that that the response does not necessarily have a consensus. Are there certain things or certain questions that have come up through the period of time that where there is a consensus?
Oh, sure. In any given age, there usually ends up being a consensus on lots of things. Name a question,
first of all, what comes to mind?
You're again dealing with euthanasia.
No, I'm not going to go back to euthanasia. I'm not that. I'm not a masochist.
Do you want to answer this?
Well, actually, a kidnapping. Actually, you know, I remember Golda Meir spoke very, very adamantly about the fact that you don't negotiate with kidnappers, and that comes to, since that was one of the Middle Ages problems that you mentioned. I was curious. That would be probably one of them.
Yeah, so that is a question in which there has been a change in the consensus. I should also have mentioned earlier that one of the charitable acts, particularly in the early Middle Ages, which was very high on their agenda, was providing money to ransom somebody. And you could take money from virtually any other cause to which it had been pledged. For that purpose. You know, somebody had said, I want this money to go to the building of the synagogue.
That would go to
and
the...
If the synagogue has not yet been started, it would go to ransom somebody. No
question. It would change then? If you're paying ransom, then...
Yes, so later on it changed. But never 100%, because the response are always practical. You know, they look at the... What has the traditional view been? Human life, of course, is enormously important. Every human life, if it looks like these folks are really serious and are going to kill people, we'll have to change our approach.
Is there anything dramatic that you can remember where there was a conflict within the group, or where there was something that was out of the ordinary?
There have been so many different things. You know, we've had all of these questions of status with Soviet Jews, which are often very difficult, but you have to handle those on an individual basis too, because the story is always different. You have people, these were questions that came up after the war, who suddenly appear, you're not quite sure whether they're Jewish or not, because they've been raised in a convent, and they're not quite sure either. And now, what do you do with them? Do you encourage them, discourage them? And although there's a consensus, again, it would pretty well go after, you know, according to individual situations.
What is the general consensus then?
Well, you if they are at all interested, you try to bring them back and make them part of the community. Or you have, you know, what do you do with, we've been through a phase here in America which has dealt with cults. They really posed a danger for a while to young people. They pose less of a danger now. So you can look at people who have been connected with them a little differently, a little less suspiciously than before.
Well, I can't resist this question now. What is your opinion then that with the German government, Kohl making a statement against Scientology and not doing it in Germany? What is, and then there
well,
seems to be the analogy that this is what happens in the 30s with Jews.
I've
what
seen
is
these,
your opinion?
These big ads.
Scientology is what I'm more interested in asking you about. What is your opinion?
I think it ought to be treated as a cult, and they probably are correct in treating it these people are not exactly up front. So it's very different than a Baptist coming and knocking on your door, because you have a clear idea of what they want, and you have a pretty clear choice. I would tend to agree more with the German approach than with their ads in the New York Times. And I've dealt with some of these folks here, too. And on Scientology, I'm still somewhat leery. On some of the other things, it's not so much a matter of our attitude towards these cults, but what do you do when somebody comes out of them? How far do you go in investigating whether they're really out of them or whether they are really want to enter your community in order to subvert it? I mean, that's
and they are subvert. I mean, they are subvert, aren't they, in here?
Frequently, yes.
Their motives are not.
Yeah, I for example, I refused recently to marry a couple in which one person is going to convert to Judaism. They've both been members of cults. I'm not entirely sure that they are out. And so, although this person is certainly going to be a convert, and you know, they can should be able to come to me, and I should be able to marry them, but I won't. And I don't think my colleagues will either.
Do you then consult with the programmers and the soul? Do you consult with anyone, or is this just your gut?
Oh, no. Yeah, you talk to people about, because, you know, what do I know about a specific
exactly.
cult?
That's what I'm
very
thinking.
Little. So I call people who have looked into this and work with these groups all over town, and who would be able right off to warn me or to say, look, this is benign. It's really just a meditation group. It hasn't gone anywhere. It isn't going anywhere. That's different.
I remember very vividly, and I'm not sure, I don't think we talked about some things that you changed after Dr. Friedhoff became Rabbi Emeritus and the book reviews, but we didn't address the lectures of Dr. Friedhoff. They were sermons, supposedly, on Sunday morning after breakfast, after the Brotherhood breakfast. But they were really almost like a lecture series. And that has not been continued. Is there a reason for it, or was it just a time?
Well, you have, I guess, as a lot of people, a short-term memory. Because they were continued till 1990. So from 66 to 90, they were continued. But let me do something else for a moment, because Gabi asked a question, and that deserves a bit of an answer too, about the Pittsburgh platform, although you're not interviewing. Hope that's all right.
No, that's fine.
I don't know.
Let's just do that for a moment.
Fine.
What is
the
Pittsburgh platform? Well, this was a platform in 1885, conceived here in Pittsburgh, and we celebrated it 10 or 11 years ago, and organized a symposium and published a book on that subject too, which discusses the platform in some detail. It set the tone for Reform Judaism for 50 years, slightly more than 50 years.
And do you remember the people who started it? Do you remember who initiated it?
Well, there were a small group of rabbis who gathered here, but who represented all the Reform rabbinate. And the person who dominated that meeting was Kaufman Kohler, who later became president of the Hebrew Union College and was a good theologian. He came in with a prepared set of statements which he felt should represent Reform Judaism. There was debate on that. There were some changes made. Then that became the basis, the unofficial basis for Reform Judaism, because aside from this ad hoc group passing it. No other group ever officially took it up or passed it. Neither the Hebrew Union College nor the lay organization, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, nor the rabbinic organization, the Central Conference of American Rabbis. But de facto, it became the expression of what Reform Judaism stood for. There are about 11 or 12 points, and I'm also not going to read that to you, and I'm not going to go into the details of the background, because in this case, Gabi, if you want that, I'll give you the book.
Well, no, there's some things that we do want on tape. I don't think that, so if Pittsburgh had a platform.
It's not a, Pittsburgh was just the site.
Okay.
All right.
So
they met here, that's all.
All right, okay.
It was for the whole country. There were very few Jews, there were Jews already on the West Coast, but most Jews lived in the Midwest or the East.
Were these primarily German Jews?
No, a mixture. So this was a convenient place to meet, and they met here at the Concordia Club, the old Concordia Club. So that means they not only met here, but they ate reasonably well.
Assuming there was a good chef.
Now, back to your question about changes. Sunday services did not change, because the Sunday service provided an opportunity for adult education, for serious adult education, which you cannot do at a late Friday night service, because late Friday night you're halfway always trying to keep the people awake and amused. And Sunday morning they are awake, and you can deal with serious themes, which Dr. Freehoff did, and which I did too. It was a weekday service with a half hour or 40 minute lecture, and sometimes some response from the, time to respond, usually not. And although it sounds good to have people respond from the congregation, that often doesn't work out, because after the third or fourth effort, you know not only who is going to say something, but you have a pretty good idea what they're going to say before they say it.
Always the same people?
Yes, and you'll find that too if you attend Quaker meetings.
Friends.
Yes, it's pretty much the same thing each time. So that wasn't, they were eventually dropped. Because interest of people in coming out on Sunday morning diminished, and they preferred other forms of adult education. But I think this is a pretty good example of how I tried to make changes. I tried to keep the older generation in their pattern as long as it was useful. And at the same time make changes in the congregational life. And I tried to make changes that were substantive first and decorative later. So one substantive change was Bar and Bat Mitzvah, which began immediately in 66 when I became rabbi. The others were a lot more adult education, a lot more serious adult education, a lot more social action, and involvement of the congregation in the social action of that day, which was largely civil rights. The more decorative changes were things, some of them you could bring about slowly and people wouldn't even notice, like increasing the amount of Hebrew. Instead of doing that overnight, I did it slowly. Changing the pattern of the music so that it becomes more singable, and eventually getting people to even sing, which 30 years later has only partially occurred. Having some of the services more informal. The Friday evening service has been established long before that, the early service, yes. But changing the pattern of that and making sure that each of the services the services that were always held, the early Friday evening, the Saturday morning, and the Sunday morning, had a different style and a different content. The amount of Hebrew varied, the type of music varied, and the nature of the sermon varied. And shifting the emphasis to Saturday morning as the main service, and making sure that that was understood. And also making sure that the bar bat mitzvah became an adjunct to that service, not the main event of the service, so that people who normally come would not feel dispossessed by some family that, you know, comes once in a lifetime. So these were changes. Then the other changes, like putting an Israeli flag up, well, that's the kind of thing people get excited about. Or wearing a talit. That, I felt, could come slowly and at some appropriate moment. And it was my nature, right or wrong, and we changed prayer books, of course, too, right or wrong, to make those kind of changes without discussion or debate.
You mentioned that on your last interview, and you mentioned it was just a gradual thing without conflict.
Well, no conflict, and also no conflict because there was no discussion. The flag was put up there. It didn't meet with the worship committee to have a lengthy discussion, which would have brought all sorts of reverberations in the congregation. It was just done.
Did you get any reverberation regardless of
whether you... Well, one person called up and said, I believe the flag is higher than the American flag and it shouldn't be. I said, it'll be changed immediately, and I asked our janitor to cut off 2 inches from the bottom of the flagpole. That was done. And some people said they didn't like it. And so we sat and talked, but we talked one-on-one rather than in a committee. You throw this out, and there's a discussion, and then people go home, they talk with other people. And the same with the talit. We just did it.
But at what point, have you ever had any major crisis here where enough congregants objected after decision was made? What input does the
Well, in matters input? Of worship and, in other words, ritual and education, the rabbi has the last word. It would be foolish to do these things if you didn't feel the congregation was with you. So when I made changes, I had a pretty good feeling. For example, when we began with the cantorial soloist, that people were at that point where they were willing to go along with that. If I had said in 66, now we're going to have an Israeli flag, we're going to read 60% Hebrew, and we're going to have a talit, and we're going to have a cantor by 68, I probably would have been somewhere else. but if you make the changes gradually, and if you carry the people along, it works fine. The only time that there was a major objection, and there I went the other route because it involved a considerable expense of money. There was a change of the High Holiday prayer book. So the worship committee, every member got a prayer book, and we gave them 2 months to read it, and there were 3 forums on what this prayer book was like. And then they voted to change. They sat through a High Holiday set of services, and they were aghast. and a lot of people, other people also felt that this was just strange to them. But they had voted on it. You know, this wasn't my unilateral decision. So then we decided, okay, for the holidays, we will use both prayer books. We will use one in the evening, the other one in the morning. And that meant that everybody felt at home or at ease. with what was done. We will probably now have gotten to the point where we can change that and drop the Union Prayer Book Volume 2 entirely and simply use the Gates of Repentance. But, you know, that's 10 years later, and okay, that's fine. But other things, the other effort was to increase the number of services to try to appeal to special groups. So for a long time there was a junior congregation service once a month, or a single service once a month, or a young couple service once a month, or a family service on Friday evening. These are all Friday evening, once a month. And in the last few years, as the number of rabbis have increased, we started a daily service. And that's every evening at 5:30. And additional Friday evening services, a family service once a month, I guess just one Friday evening service, an informal library service early on Saturday morning once a month, a tot service once a month. So these, but you have to realize that these things come and go. Something that's popular for a while then just drops by the wayside. And then, of course, in addition to that, lots of things for teenagers, for kids of all ages, more emphasis on the youth camps. Well, that's difficult because we're so far away from them. Informal sessions with the confirmation class and other parts of the school out in the country, bus trips on Sunday morning to various other sites. Now, these kinds of things that which are constantly changing. You know, when we had, I think I mentioned that before, very popular coffee houses for maybe 5 or 6 years, and then that vanished. And the other thing is a major summer program, which is probably 25 years old, so that we do not close down as we used to in the summer. Lots of things happening, classes, special programs, music programs, something virtually every, not every day perhaps in the summer, but maybe 3 or 4 times a week.
Curious, since there's so much activity in the temple, there's obviously a need for it, or as you said, you have to be very practical. I'm sure you share many things with other theologians in the Christian community. Is that sort of a new trend, or is this something that occurs in different churches as well, or is this just something unique to Rhode of Sholem?
I think there we are unique, and also I've tried to get us imitated by other Jewish congregations, and tried in some way, part, even to embarrass people into that. So, for example, for a while we published a list of adult education offerings by Reform and Conservative congregations in Pittsburgh, with the thought that you could cross-register. But in the back of my mind was more the thought of embarrassing congregations that were doing very little to do more, and to feel that they had to in order to at least appear good, if nothing else.
How successful?
It worked to some extent, but we have a lot more going than any other congregation in the city, Christian or Jewish, and there are maybe a half a dozen other congregations in the country that have equally full programs. A lot of places still shut down in the summer.
Yeah, summer, I guess.
But this is also the location. You know, it's a community. I mean, many of these activities are community.
Yes, but you could do that, and I've talked to people about that, and lots of other places too. I talked, for example, giving some lectures in Cleveland, and asked, you know, why don't you have a lecture series out here? Why don't you have a concert series out here? It takes 40 minutes to drive into the symphony, the Severn Hall. And they said, well, I mean, that's about the best answer I got.
Well, it takes a tremendous energy from all the rabbis.
Well, you just do it. It's
not a given.
Yeah, but it's possible anywhere.
Yeah.
And I've always thought that what you need to do is you need to try and offer it. And never mind a lot of debate on whether it'll go or not go. The only way you'll discover that is by doing it.
People showing up or not.
Yeah, so for example, one season we decided, people said that the times are all difficult for us. You know, daytime is difficult, evening is difficult, weekend is difficult. What are you going to do? So I said, all right, we're going to have a couple of classes right after work. 5:30 to 6:30, and we'll try that for maybe 6 or 8 sessions in a row. Well, some people came, but it certainly was no overwhelming success. And we've tried the downtown sessions. You know, go to where the people are.
So where would you hold those?
In a law office, in their conference room. So at noon, or at 1 o'clock. Well, those things worked for a little while. But our business people, our professional people are very good.